is made possible with support from the Wake the Sleeping Giant campaign of Empty Tombs National Work, whose theme is Been to Church, Now What? More information is at www.wakethesleepinggiant.info. Today's programming is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering a collection of products from more than 30 third world countries, from Vietnamese ceramics and textiles to Bolivian musical instruments and international home decor.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. This afternoon, we'll take a look at Benjamin Franklin's mission to France. Franklin went to France in 1776. He spent 8 years there. Biographer Stacy Schiff says those years should be considered his crowning achievement. She says the fate of our infant republic was to a significant extent in his hands. Without the aid of the French, the American Revolution would have failed. Stacy Schiff's new book is a great improvisation, Franklin, France, and the Birth of America. To do the research for this book, Stacy Schiff moved her family to the neighborhood where Franklin lived. She spent her days reading primary resource material that had not been thoroughly examined previously. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. I look forward to hearing from you. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you just a bit more about our guest. Stacy Schiff won the Pulitzer Prize for biography in 2000 for Vera, Portrait of a Marriage, her biography of Mrs. Vladimir Nabokov. Her new book about Franklin, A Great Improvisation, is published by Henry Holt. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Stacy Schiff, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me, Celeste.
Sure. Tell us about the year you spent in France researching this biography and the materials you were able to mine for new insights into both Franklin and his mission.
Well, you know, the delight about Franklin's French years is that they are so closely observed. He is hands down one of the most famous men in the world at this point, and he is hands down one of the most watched. So the amount of material was exceptional. He was encircled in Paris by a net of British spies, who of course were hoping he wouldn't make any inroads with the French government. And those spies are encircled by a whole bunch of French observers. Both sets of men are taking close account of what's happening in his household. And all of those dispatches, all of those papers, are available today in either the French or the British archives.
Now, why hadn't these sources been examined more thoroughly before?
Well, some of them have been examined. Much diplomatic historians have mined some of the French materials in the French State Department. The material, however, is hard to get to. It's in French. Much of it is still encoded, in fact, Celeste. It hasn't been, in 200 and whatever years, it hasn't been deciphered yet. You know, some of it's moldy. One of my favorite sets of documents were the French police reports, which are the ones which spread the report on, you know, Franklin's laundry looks magnificently white today, Franklin's in a bad mood today, so-and-so had lunch with Franklin today. And those documents, I'm not sure really why no one had requested. Essentially what it was the day-to-day police observers' accounts of everything that was happening with every foreigner in Paris. And it's incredibly absorbing reading because it's really just kind of high-class gossip.
Yeah.
And those may have just slipped through the net because they're in a strange place. In other cases, it was really just a matter of tracking things down.
So are there still some things that are left in code that haven't...
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. And you know, of course, for the biographer who was afflicted by obsessive compulsive disorder, that's a terrible thing to find out. There was also a lot of material which has only been slightly mined elsewhere because, you know, Franklin being in Europe on a very crucial and originally secret mission is observed by every other foreign diplomat in Paris. So the, you know, Turinese ambassador, the Portuguese ambassador, the Prussian ambassador, everyone is writing to his home court about Franklin. and I perhaps got 80% of that material. I never managed to get all of it. And it was great and very fresh material, often eyewitness accounts, you know, personal conversations with Franklin, but it, because of the fact that it was spread all over Europe, it was hard to track down.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure in this conversation this afternoon, we're going to return to the business of Versailles and the salons and the espionage that went on. But I want to ask you some big questions here at the outset, so we're sure to cover them. Franklin was sent to France to ask a monarchy to support a new republic. France, an imperial power, a superpower, was there concern that the American colonies would find themselves being ruled by France rather than the British?
Your question is a good one. The colonies, I don't think, ever really take seriously the idea that they will be, in some way, they will fall under French submission. Certainly people discuss it. More to the point, there is no choice. There is no money in the colonies. There are no munitions. There's very little common cause. Some foreign power has to underwrite our revolution. And that's clear to Congress even before they declare independence. And in fact, the discussion of independence is inextricably bound up with whom are we going to apply to for aid and which should we do first. Does it make more sense to declare independence first, or does it make more sense to go to France or whomever and say, would you like to help us fight the British? More to the point, it was clear to Congress that the French would be delighted to step in, and moreover had made clear that they were watching for this revolution and waiting for this revolution and hoping it would happen for some time. So they were the obvious candidate when it came to, in some way, undermining the British.
Yeah. The French were interested in America as the enemy of their enemy.
Precisely. And yeah. There's no, you know, the interesting thing is that it's such a collision of self-interest. We go to the French essentially to help us attain our independence. And as you point out, it's a very strange thing to be applying to a monarchy for help in establishing a republic. But they come to us only because they want revenge on the British for the previous war and are hoping that they can some way topple the British government, some way undermine British hegemony by helping us. So it's really a matter of each of us pursuing our own agendas. And that's how we come out to this common place.
Yeah. Well, French aid was critical. The Americans, we couldn't afford to fire a cannon. How much aid did the French ultimately supply?
It's hard to put a dollar figure on an 18th century figure today. However, the number that seems most closest to the truth would come out to something like $13 billion today. The number is really less significant than what actually was sent. I mean, there were no, it's very clear at the start that there is no gunpowder in the colonies. It's Franklin who says we didn't dare fire a cannon, and we didn't tell our people the reason why, because it would have just been too depressing to have done so, but we had no gunpowder. There were no guns, there were no uniforms, and it's important to remember there was no manufacturing in the colonies. So really every bit of war material that we needed came from France. All of those cases of gunpowder, all of those munitions were French supplied. The shopping list that gets sent to Franklin when he's in France from Congress are almost hilarious. They're sort of 36-page documents, and they not only include the 60,000 uniforms and the 60,000 extra bolts of cloth, but also paint and cymbals and sheet music and clarinets, just everything you can imagine, because nothing was being manufactured here in America.
Hmm. The opening line of this biography is, in December 1776, a small boat delivered an old man to France. Benjamin Franklin was 70 years old. Now, in 1776, that's pretty old. How was it that Benjamin Franklin was chosen for this mission?
Interestingly, we don't know exactly how he's chosen, because Congress destroys its records in those years for security's sake. He was the obvious choice, though. He's the only American who really has spent any time in Europe. He'd been for almost 15 previous years in London as a colonial representative. So he's the only one who really knows the larger world. He is the known conciliator. He's the known fixer, in a way, among Americans. He has a civic spirit, and he has a real way of working people and raising funds. So he's an obvious choice in that respect as well. And it is commonly understood that he speaks French, which was a little bit inaccurate. But he speaks more French than most Americans of his time. And it's certainly a mission that he accepts quite willingly.
Yeah. His command of French was rudimentary. Why wasn't that lethal for his diplomatic efforts?
I think it's a good question. I think for a lesser man, the French would have the lack of French would have been lethal. Franklin is so esteemed, so celebrated in France. He is the best known American in the world. He's the man who's tamed the lightning. Remember that it's France who first recognizes his scientific work, more so than any other nation comes to see him as a man of the future, as a man of the Enlightenment. And so when he touches down in France, when he arrives in France in 1776, he's seen as this kind of embodiment of an ideal. He's seen as an almost walking statue of liberty, and he can get away with murder. And, you know, the French are very accepting when it comes to someone whom they admire. And he's a very charming man. He's able to parlay his very bad French into an enormously successful mission.
Was there something more than anti-British sentiment that motivated the French? I mean, here we have the French admiring, great admirers of Benjamin Franklin.
There are two different levels at work, in a way, among the French government. Or there are three, I suppose. There's Louis XVI, who plays no real role except to do essentially what his ministers advise him. There are his ministers whose sole purpose is really retaliation against the British. And then around those ministers, there's a whole sort of coterie of liberal aristocrats. And in a way, they are a key to American independence. It is they who most admire Franklin, most admire the American experiment, have most dabbled in these ideas of human progress and human freedom. And they, in a way, infect, they are the key to Franklin's popularity in France. They, in a way, infect the corridors of Versailles with a sort of enthusiasm for the American cause. But ultimately, that popular opinion is not what brings the monies to America. That is really this underlying sense that anything that can be done to hurt the British is a good thing.
Hmm. He struggled with the language, but, you know, one of the things he is known for during his years in France is great charm. How did he pull it off?
You know, I'm always amazed when I read Franklin by how he's able to size a person up in a matter of seconds and to respond to them in their terms. And the accounts of this everywhere, but particularly in France, where he doesn't have the sinuousness that he would have in his native language, are really striking. I mean, there's no one whom Franklin rejects out of hand. There's nothing in Franklin's mind like a stupid question. He takes everyone at face value, with the possible exception, you might point out, of some of his colleagues, but we can talk about that later. But very, just extremely open-minded and extremely flexible. And part of that, I think, is that he realizes that human foibles are a constant. You know, we may speak different languages, we may come from different cultures, we may hail from different religions, but a man is a man, and a man tends to have the same investments in the same things. So that all of his aphorisms, all of the wisdoms that he puts into his very sort of commonsensical American writing, he's able to use later in this much more elaborate, much more Baroque world, in a very different language and in a very different way.
Mm. A man is a man. Would you say something of the ladies Franklin charmed?
Well, the ladies were not the ladies when it came to Franklin. There are two, I think probably, and it's sad to say, but I think probably Franklin's reputation as a womanizer in Paris is quite overinflated. To my mind, it is largely the work of John Adams, who in his puritanical way did a good job of reporting home on Dr. Franklin's conquest. But that said, there are two women in whom he's extremely interested in Paris. One, Madame Brion, who's a woman half his age, a woman in her 30s, who is the age of his daughter, and whom he has a very flirtatious relationship with on paper, and a very close, intimate relationship with in truth, but nothing, I'm afraid, that ventures into the sexual. And the second of whom is another neighbor, but a little further away, Madame Hevesius, who's the widow of a very well-known philosopher, a man whom Franklin would have had a lot in common with, in fact, who's a woman in her 60s and whom he would very much like to marry. However, she does not think that's such a great idea, and she, alas, resists all of his advances.
Mm. These women were important to Franklin's mission, were they not?
Both of them are important in that, in individual realms, they are very key to this whole level of sort of liberal intelligentsia that I was talking about. Madame Helvétius connects him as well to the Masons, which many of these liberal aristocrats were members of. As well, there's just an enormous weight to popularity. I mean, this is a different kind of media age, and hearsay was very important, and rumor was very important. And Franklin showed up in the right places, and he knew the right people, and this was worth a tremendous amount in that world. And part of that is indeed the influence that these two women lend him. They put a very human face on this figurehead.
Hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, biographer Stacy Schiff. Her new book is A Great Improvisation, Franklin, France, and the Birth of America. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions, comments. Look forward to hearing from you. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Ben Franklin was not the first American sent to Europe to seek help from the French. There was a fellow by the name of Silas Deane who went ahead of Franklin. Was he able to accomplish anything?
Silas Deane, who's a Connecticut businessman, actually does a quite good job. What he doesn't have, however, is Franklin's stature, or for that matter, Franklin's flexibility in terms of negotiating things. He does a fairly good job. He isn't able to give the mission the weight and the prominence that Franklin is able to give it on his arrival. What Deane instead imparts is an enormous amount of ill will among what would become the four colleagues in Paris, Franklin and two others and Deane. And that will explode during Franklin's third year in France into an enormous party scandal in Congress, from which Franklin's reputation really never recovers. It's a very strange fact of the Paris years that until the arrival of Thomas Jefferson, who gets there in 1784, Franklin doesn't get along with any one of his colleagues particularly. And for a long time, I would write that down to the faults of the colleagues. But in the end, I think one has to assume that there was some fault on both sides.
Yeah. What were their complaints? His own countrymen were his greatest enemies in France. What were their complaints?
For the most part, the complaint from the really radical faction was that he was corrupt, and there was a sense that he was sitting in Paris, essentially profiting from these transactions with America. That is not true, although the bookkeeping left a very great deal to be desired. Franklin, you know, who always had a good deal to say about exactitude, was a terrible accountant. He was also a bad correspondent, although none of his enemies ever point that out. He's terrible at corresponding with Congress. In a less vitriolic way, John Adams, who was his colleague sort of intermittently, takes him to task for essentially being lazy, for being dissipated, for spending all his time socializing and very little time at his desk, which was true to the extent that Franklin realized that was how business was done in France. Adams had this idea that business was done in a somewhat more American way, a somewhat more straightforward business way. Franklin was really working the living rooms, the salon of Paris, and quite effectively so. But in the eyes of John Adams, he was essentially having a good time.
Mm. And that also led to charges that he'd gone native.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. It's really the popularity of Franklin is what sticks in the craw the most, I think, with all of his colleagues, but particularly with Adams. And that's understandable. It's almost inconceivable today. Franklin's popularity is just his image is everywhere. It's inescapable. His face is on cups and mugs and walking sticks and cigarette boxes and wallpaper. And it really did drive his colleagues, who were meant to be on an equal footing with him for several years. It drove them really crazy.
Mm. He was a superstar.
He was a superstar, and that's a hard thing to have to do business with.
Yeah. We have a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us. Let's go first to a caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if you discovered any kind of stuff about perhaps Franklin and his interests, if any, with the French and British rivalry for colonial possessions in Africa and Asia and Latin America, which is what the big cause of the war was probably about anyway.
The idea of the Americans was very simple. They didn't really want to play into any kind of French and British race for other territories. They wanted to get into the war, they wanted to get the French funding, and they wanted to get out of the war. And essentially the conquest of other territories, the conquest of other islands, will come up during the peace negotiations in 1782, which is largely led by John Jay, not as much by Franklin, who's extremely ill by that point. But at all times, the Americans hold fast to this idea that they'll do whatever they need to do to essentially make an end run around the British, to essentially get their independence and move on. The French do try to undermine things and do try to essentially take advantage of the Americans and add a little bit of territory, but everyone's efforts in the end come to naught.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line 4 in Indiana. Hi.
Hello. Did Franklin speak fluent French?
Franklin,
how did he communicate with
French? That's a very good question. Franklin's French is a blessing to any of those of us who have studied a foreign language and not entirely succeeded. There was a wonderful sort of posthumous report card offered up of Franklin's French by Morris Bishop, the great Cornell scholar in the 1960s, and he essentially gives him an A-minus for his oral comprehension, a B-minus in his spoken French, and a downright F for his written skills. And Bishop did that with the wonderful caveat that although the compositions were error-filled, they were, however, utterly clear. And to my mind, in a nutshell, that's also why they were not French. But the fact is he was fine on the page. He had trouble making himself understood. He had trouble understanding people. This is on the arrival. Obviously, things get better as he stays longer in France. But, you know, he's always able to make himself understood either with the help of friends who were bilingual, and some of those were some of the liberal intelligentsia around him, or with his grandson who goes to France with him and quite quickly learns very, very good French and who takes care of a great amount of the written work. And also because with any one of Franklin's brains and stature, the French tend to be very obliging, which they were.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. His grandson, very interesting figure in this story. In part, he's interesting because his father is interesting, too.
Right.
And his grandfather, of course, is interesting. William Temple Franklin. Tell us about this grandson.
Well, I guess you would say this was the realm in which Franklin really gets the failing grade, the family relations. Franklin's son, who many people hasten to point out was his illegitimate son, born in 1730, is the royal governor of New Jersey when the war begins. And he never deserts his loyalist ideals. He remains a full-blooded Englishman, and he's put in prison. Franklin goes off speaking terms with him, stops speaking to him the year before the departure for Paris, and he somewhat retaliates against his son, in my eyes anyway, by taking with him the son's son, also an illegitimate son, to Paris. So William Temple Franklin, the 17-year-old grandson, heads off to France in 1776 with Benjamin Franklin, whom he serves as unofficial secretary. He's actually very good at the job, but it's the rug being pulled out from under him, the carpet being pulled out from under him at this point. He's really uprooted completely from his father and from his country and taken to France. And he serves ably during Franklin's mission in France, however, develops an enormous fondness for Europe and a yearning to serve in the diplomatic service, which he's never granted by Congress. He's never really taken seriously, and he's never really accepted as an American. So he comes back to America with Franklin in 1785, discovers, as many of us will, that living outside in New Jersey after 8 years in Paris is a little bit dull, and goes back to Europe and makes a couple of extremely bad real estate transactions, sires a second illegitimate child himself, and dies penniless in Paris. So it's a very sad story, in fact. And he's buried today. Franklin's son is buried in England, and his grandson is buried in France. So he's this kind of American who ends up with a son who's British and a grandson who's French, in a way.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Champaign. Line 1, go ahead.
At that time, was Franklin able to converse with some of the Europeans in Latin? Johnson did so very much
exactly.
A few years later.
Exactly. That always amused me that Johnson reverted to Latin. I have no evidence that Franklin's Latin was that good, in fact. The written French is very straightforward and very basic. He tries to give himself lessons in bettering it, but I don't have any account of his trying to converse in Latin. Everyone testifies to the fact that he is by nature a taciturn man. He's a very silent man. But many of the French interlocutors testify to the fact that he would often wait a full 4 or 5 or 6 minutes even before answering, which, you know, as we know, is a really uncomfortably long silence. But some of that, I think, was summoning his thoughts, and some of that, I think, was trying to really convert it into French. So he worked pretty hard at it.
Franklin, unlike a number of the founding fathers, wasn't a college graduate, right?
That's right.
Adams, for instance, would have, I think, have been a Harvard graduate.
That's correct.
And probably would have been proficient in Latin.
John Adams sweated the French language tremendously when he got to Paris. And
mm-hmm.
for him, one of the not-so-happy discoveries was that Franklin's French was extremely poor as well. Adams took the opposite approach. Franklin tried to perfect his, in the living rooms of Paris, Adams sat in his room and tried to study books as hard as he could. The results on both counts were pretty unacceptable, or pretty insufficient in any case. I've never seen any evidence that Adams reverted to Latin. There's definitely a sort of class thing or an educational snobism between Adams and Franklin, in the sense that Franklin is the only founding father without a college education. And among the colleagues in Paris, he's the only one who really has made his way in the world. He's the lowest born, I guess you would say, which some of us find the most appealing part about him. Some of his colleagues found that was just the opposite.
Mm. Very interesting. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Yes, I think he only had a couple of years of formal schooling of any kind.
Everything else is exactly a couple of years of grade school, otherwise self-taught. And in the eyes of some of these colleagues in Paris who were Southern gentlemen, extremely well-educated, some of them with multiple graduate degrees, he was really kind of a low-born upstart. I mean, there was really a sense that there was something illegitimate about Franklin himself for his very lack of background.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener in Urbana, a caller on line two. Good afternoon.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you, in terms of the eventual French Revolution, could you talk a little bit about that? Do you know any of the major figures of the French Revolution? Did he see any signs of it coming? Were people tapping his brain in terms of that?
It's a wonderful question. He knows many of the people who will become the major players in the Revolution. And it's interesting because, of course, many of them know him in a completely different context. For example, one of the young scientists who follows his work so closely becomes a major revolutionary player. Robespierre, at one point, who's a young lawyer, writes to Franklin about legal matters. None of them touch his life in the terms that they will become famous for later. And the truly stunning part is that Franklin does not see the French Revolution coming. He sees no hints of it whatsoever. And when he's asked outright by rather learned people in France if he thinks that what has happened in America could ever happen in France, his answer is quite simply no. He just can't imagine that a government that he thinks is as well-loved and well-established as the French one could ever be overthrown. That said, what happens ironically is that he becomes a kind of patron saint after his departure of the French Revolution, a role that he would never have imagined his playing.
You say he thought the aristocracy in France was well-loved?
He doesn't see... Now, remember, Franklin never went to the butcher himself, as far as I can tell, when he lived in France. I mean, he had very little sense. He lived in a rather cosseted way in France. And, you know, his eggs and his fish and his daily bread are brought to his door. He doesn't have a huge amount of contact with what we know as the people of Paris. And the revolutionary ideas that we can see in retrospect had not begun to brew, at least in his household, yet at this time. When he's asked outright if he sees anything that could possibly amount to a revolution, he says no. He's absolutely oblivious to it.
That's amazing. Thanks.
Thanks for the call. Good question. Other questions, comments are invited here this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest is biographer Stacy Schiff. Her latest book, A Great Improvisation, Franklin, France, and the Birth of America. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to join the discussion, here are the phone numbers. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The title of your book, A Great Improvisation, works on a couple of different levels, and one of them, of course, is that Franklin's great improvisation was to teach himself diplomacy on the job while serving as America's unofficial banker. What was his learning curve?
Well, it's a very good point you make. Franklin stumbles a great deal during these years in Paris, and part of the problem is that he's out of touch completely with Congress. On a good day in these years, you got word across the ocean in sort of 2 to 3 months. Most of the time, given the war, word never got through. So that at one point, Franklin goes without news for 18 months, and Congress also, by the way, does not hear from Franklin for 18 months. So part of his problem is that he's in utter isolation. And it's not just that he's not receiving his orders. It's not just that he doesn't know what to do with his orders. He's not receiving orders, and he's not receiving news. So he really is making things up. He seems to figure the French out quite quickly. There are certain things he never masters. And people are always an easy feat for Franklin: bookkeeping, practical details, shipping munitions. These are realms in which he does not excel by any means. And part of that is that shouldn't have been part of his job. His job should have been the diplomacy. But because Congress does not entirely equip him with a full staff, he ends up doing things that like being a counsel, playing provision supplier, which he had not counted on doing. And those do not play to Benjamin Franklin's strengths by any stretch. So he's quick on the diplomacy, and he's very quick on inventing things. He's very quick on inventing, for example, American victories that never happened, just to be able to string the French along. He's very quick to start mailing back to America anthems to the American spirit. He writes these amazing letters about, you know, our cause is the cause of all Europe. You know, blessed are we to have been chosen for this amazing task. Things which are completely full-blown lies. All of Europe is by no means with the Americans, but he knows these are being intercepted, and he wants the British to be reading these kinds of documents. Mm. So he's very quick on how to play the two powers off each other, very quick on realizing what the power game is at Versailles. He never realizes that France is part of a larger Europe. He never really sees beyond French politics. And that's true, I think, of all the Americans of Paris. None of them realize that from the point of view of the rest of Europe, this is all part of a much larger game. They really see, the Americans really see it in their own very, very small context.
Mm. The business of espionage, the French are marvelous spies here in this story. The British have their spies. What would you like to tell us about this world, the world of espionage in the 18th century?
Well, the espionage, which was utterly fascinating to me, and of course is the biographer's gift because it's why we know as much as we know, because these men did such amazing work, was so thorough. Franklin has in his household a secretary named Bancroft, who is not known to have been a spy until 60 years after Bancroft's own death. Franklin never discovers that Bancroft was spying on him. And it is Bancroft's job every week to get in his carriage with copies of all of Franklin's papers and drive them to the gardens of the Tuileries, where he stuffs them under a tree into a bottle and then lowers that bottle into the ground on a string. And they are then collected by the British ambassador's staff, who send them back to Paris, to London, so that they essentially make it from Franklin's household to London within about 10 days at the most. None of those documents, especially for the early years, ever really make their way back to America. So there's a full set of documents of what is happening in Franklin's household that is sent immediately to London. And that perfidy, that treachery on Bancroft's part, also goes undetected by the French spies, who think that they are watching the household so carefully. And this is the one leak that they never detect. So I guess the amazing thing to me was how the British and the French are again able to outwit each other. And it's really this sort of spy versus spy. There are so many observers around Franklin that they're stumbling over each other at all times. And they often complain that so-and-so is in their way without knowing that so-and-so is also a spy and he's also complaining about them. And it's actually very funny because the spies are constantly complaining back to the British State Department officials that they're not being well enough paid, and if only they could do more work, they could perhaps make more money. But they don't realize that there are three other spies who are already in the employ of the same office doing that work. And Franklin just sort of moves through it all in a somewhat oblivious way and in a somewhat careless way. He's extremely lax about security, to the point where at one point he's visited by a very dubious character who seems to have been sent by the British ambassador to assassinate him. And at that point he gets a little more concerned, but he's otherwise relatively oblivious to the fact that he is being so closely monitored.
Yeah. Well, you've talked about Bancroft, the British spy. Tell us about this very colorful secret agent, a Frenchman, you liken to the Scarlet Pimpernel, Beaumarchais.
Well, Beaumarchais was the scene stealer for me. He's not only always present, but he's eminently quotable. And we actually owe him a good deal. It's really Beaumarchais to whom we owe the first munitions. It's Beaumarchais, who's a playwright and hyper-dramatic in a somewhat histrionic way, who starts essentially selling the American Revolution to the French government and saying, you know, here is the perfect point of entry to start to retaliate against the British. This is an opportunity we won't see again in our lifetimes. We must take advantage of this unrest in the colonies to disestablish the British. We must start sending these people munitions. We can do so underhandedly, and I'm the man who can do it. And he is indeed the original gun runner before Franklin's arrival. Once Franklin gets to France, Beaumarchais is a little bit put off because, of course, this means that he may not occupy center stage any longer. So he continues to try to insert himself into the situation with varying degrees of success. But if he's not sure what's happening in Franklin's household and he's not sure the French government is leveling with him about it, he'll send his own spies. So then you get another set of informers in the picture as well.
Phew.
It was a lot of paper to read.
Yeah.
But it was blessedly rich in detail.
Sure. Now let's talk about Beaumarchais' patron, the French foreign minister. You describe him as known at Versailles for qualities that did not endear him there: thrift, industry, prudence, and gravity. Were those qualities beneficial to Franklin?
Well, they were in a way, in the sense that Vergennes, who is the French foreign minister, and really the man who's most responsible for our independence, because it is he whom Beaumarchais convinces to enter the revolution on the side of the Americans, and it is he who continues to send money and munitions over the years. He has an enormous respect for Franklin, and I do think that there's a certain... He has no respect for any of the other Americans who come near him. If anything, he has a disrespect for them. And I do think that it is partly because the two men have something in common. There's a certain embrace of industry on both of their parts, and they see eye to eye, and they do get along well. And that helps the American cause immeasurably. Vergennes is never of the opinion that the colonies will amount to a real country. What's fascinating about these years is reading how many times the French say, that country will acquire no consistency, they'll never be able to get along, they'll never represent a world power, there's really no problem helping them because they'll never be a threat to us, which Vergennes was utterly convinced of. The single American whom he could respect, however, under those conditions, was Franklin.
Hmm. How did Franklin manage to keep the French in hand through the war and at the end when the Americans sign a treaty with the British?
Well, that's where the utter suppleness and flexibility of Franklin's character really comes into play. I mean, he's not only well-liked and well-respected at Versailles, and not only a great advertisement for the American cause, but he is able all along to keep the French interested, even when there's no money in their treasury, but they're still sending millions of old francs to help us. And it's really because Franklin has charmed them to such an extent and has been able to prove to them that this is really something that they must continue to back. And now that they're in halfway, they need to continue doing so. He's very careful. It's a very interesting moment at which John Adams essentially argues, the end of 1778, we really need to issue an ultimatum to the French. We need to insist that they help us more assiduously, more aggressively. And Franklin says, you know, no, this is a country that takes pity on the underdog. This is a country that prides itself on helping the oppressed. We don't issue ultimatums. We ask for their aid as a matter of grace. And that was really his attitude. He never sort of says to the French, here's what you'll get out of the deal. You'll get American trade. He makes it seem much more as if it's a mission of mercy. And that's far more appealing to the French. And to have read that into the situation was really quite brilliant on his part. He is sent back to see the French ministers after the peace is signed, at which point the Americans have somewhat undermined the French. And again, he's an image of sheer benevolence. He's an image of utter charm and being able to say, yes, we made a big mistake, and we're terribly sorry, and we hope you'll forgive us.
Hmm. You know, here you just talked about John Adams and how he was stirring things up. And, you know, Franklin had trouble with other of his countrymen in France. This American infighting, did it at any point threaten the Republic?
It certainly does on the European side. The spectacle of the Americans in Paris fighting is something of a delight to the British. They can't believe that here the Americans are in the middle of this very, very, very difficult contest, and they're constantly sniping about each other and going around Paris bad-mouthing each other. It is Lafayette who makes many trips back and forth between the two countries, who in those years writes to Washington several times and says, you must get them to stop fighting because it's the thing that's going to do you in. It's the greatest obstacle to the American cause at this point. It doesn't make us look like a particularly solid and viable concern when our best representatives can't even see eye to eye. it's very, for me, it was one of the great revelations. I had no idea that there was any animosity among any of these individuals, and especially the animosity among Franklin and Adams, two men who are not only working together, but often sharing a house and seeing each other daily. The idea that the revolution actually worked, that we managed, that we succeed in this amazing quest when many of the key players were not fond of each other is extraordinary.
How does Franklin compare to the other founders?
Well, for one thing, Franklin is infinitely older. Franklin is the grandfather of our country. He's retired almost by the time that that Jefferson and Adams are born. He's a man of few words, and this is the thing probably that drove Adams most crazy. He's the quiet one. He's the reticent one. He's the one who holds back. And I think partly on account of his age, he's the patient one. And for a bunch of hot-headed revolutionaries, that was a rarity. So he stands out for those reasons. He also stands out for the idea that he, it is Franklin's belief from the beginning, that America will win the revolution if she can just hold her own. If Washington can keep from being, if he can just hold the British at bay, America will ultimately prevail. The numbers are on our side. We are on the side of the angels. And no one else, I think, had that confidence, nor the vision. I mean, Franklin really sees what America could become from the outset.
Yeah, that's interesting because I know Stanley Weintraub has a new book out where he essentially argues that the British were just worn down. They got tired of it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Franklin just assumes that will happen sooner or later, that the Americans are fighting for a set of ideals, and that just from a population, from a raw population point of view, America will ultimately prevail. We had more land. We would ultimately have more people. It was just going to be a matter of time. And because of that, it affords him a certain confidence and a certain patience, which comes in very handy from a diplomatic point of view.
Among his countrymen, who were his greatest allies?
Silas Deane, whom, as you mentioned, the initial envoy, and Franklin get along very well. And Franklin continues to defend Deane even after the American mission has sort of imploded and Deane has been disgraced. And that is actually a mistake on Franklin's part because, again, it makes the mission look like it's very disorganized unto itself. The only colleague with whom he gets along among the Americans is Jefferson, who arrives in 1784. He will ultimately replace Franklin. And the two of them very much see eye to eye. They have almost nothing in common. They have less in common than probably Franklin and any other colleague. But there's a raw respect there on Jefferson's part for Franklin. And there's an intellectual connection between the two of them. And until that point, there is almost no one with whom Franklin is able to stay on good terms.
Let's take one more call this afternoon, but it will have to be, we'll have to get through it here rather quickly. Line one, a listener in Urbana. Go ahead.
I recently finished reading Isaacson's biography of Franklin. Do you have any criticism of that book? And I'll hang up and listen.
I have no criticism of that book. I actually think it's terrific. Where this book will differ, you'll see, is that I have made a book out of what is for Walter a short chapter, or two short chapters, I'm not sure which, in Franklin's life. It's my sense that you can see Franklin best in the French years, that he's out of context, he's vulnerable, he's in a language in which he's not comfortable, he's not surrounded by people who are necessarily helpful, he's lonely very often, and he's sick. And that because there is so much paper from these years, there's 2.5 times as much paper for the 8 years in Paris as for the entire rest of the life combined, you actually get a more intimate look at Franklin the man than you do from any other chapter in his life. And the other reason why I sort of make so much of this these particular years is that they are, to me, the signal achievement of Franklin's life. This is a moment where one man really changes the course of history. No other American could have accomplished this at the time. And it's the crucial task. It is to the revolution just as important as Washington's work in America is to the revolution. This is just the other side of the revolution.
Hmm. At the end of the book, you leave us with Franklin telling a French friend, "In this world, it is not faith that saves us, but defiance. Some Americans today would reverse that." How do you feel about Franklin in the end, summing him up? Does that, in a nutshell, say it?
It did for me. You know, I hadn't thought to reverse it. You're very right about that. It did for me. I mean, there's something from the start with Franklin. Much has been made of the fact that Franklin comes late to the revolution, which is true. He's a conciliatory man by nature. He spends a lot of time in England. He tries to keep the colonies from breaking off. However, he is by nature a rebel. He's a man who had trouble with authority from his earliest years. He falls out with his family. He falls out with his brother. He runs away from home to Philadelphia to start anew. He's very clear in his autobiography about the fact that he doesn't make amends when he goes home. He doesn't like to be told what to do. And he takes badly, in fact, to direction. And he's the whole hoax, his whole love of the hoax is him being able to sort of stick needles in people whom he thinks are being pompous or directorial. So it seems to me that that is, from the start, one of the themes of the life. The fact that he happens to live when he does, and that those revolutionary character happens to coincide with our revolution, is quite lovely. But I think at all times and in any place, someone like Franklin would have been the person who pushed the envelope in some way, the person who embraced innovation, embraced new thinking.
Hmm. Stacy Schiff, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste.
Stacy Schiff is the author of A Great Improvisation, Franklin, France, and the Birth of America. The book is published by Henry Holt. Our guest, Stacy Schiff, will be speaking next week on Tuesday, April 19th at noon at the Union League Club of Chicago. So if you're in the Chicago area listening to us there this afternoon, perhaps you'd be interested in this event at the Union League Club of Chicago. Reservations are required, and they need to be made through the bookstall in Winnetka. And that number is 847-446-8880. That's the bookstall in Winnetka. I'm sure you can find them in the phone book as well. That's the Union League Club of Chicago, Tuesday, April 19th at noon. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. This afternoon from the Chicago Board of Trade, futures finished the day like this in the wheat pit. The May contract today had a high of $3.10, the low there at $3.03, and a settlement price at $3.05 and a quarter. They were off 3 3/4 today. July futures, $3.19, the high, the low at $3.12, settlement price at $3.14 and a quarter, and they finished down 4 cents for the day. September futures off 4 1/2 at $3.26 and a half, high, low at $3.20, settlement price at $3.20 and a half, down 4 1/2, and December, $3.37, the high, the low, $3.29 and a half, settlement price at $3.31 and a half. They're off 3 1/2 cents. March contract down 2 1/4 cents in the wheat pit, $3.44, the high, the low at $3.39, and a settlement price at $3.40 and a quarter. And the numbers on the weekly trade were down about 4 3/4 and 5 3/4 in the May and July contract for the wheat, just about what their losses were for the day. Fortunately for us, we'll have Mike Zuzulo on this afternoon during the closing market report, and you might recall that Mike tends to believe that if corn is going to go anywhere, it has to follow wheat to some extent. That based primarily on the idea that while wheat in the U.S. is not a feedstuff, it certainly is around the rest of the world, and that we need to follow some of that as we go through the marketing year. We'll talk with Mike at just about 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock this afternoon, not too far away, about 13, 14 minutes, during the closing market report. From the corn pit this afternoon, futures were down about a penny to a penny and a half for the day. Nearby May contract was off 1 1/4. Settlement price there at 206 and a quarter. They had a high of 207 and three quarters, and the May's low for the day in the futures at 204 and three quarters. Once again, that contract settling in the corn pit at 206 and a quarter for the lead option, down a penny and a quarter for the day. July futures now 216, the high, the low at 213 and a quarter. Settled $2.14 and a quarter since they were off 1 1/2, and the September futures in the corn pit down a penny and a quarter today. 222 and 3/4, the high, the low at $2.20 and a half, and a settlement price at 221 and a quarter a bushel, down 1 1/4 for the September contract. December corn, 232 the high, the low 229 and a quarter. This is your harvest month. 230 and a quarter settlement price for the new crop Dease corn, down a penny and a quarter for the day. The March contract off 1 cent, 238 and three quarters the high, the low at 236 and a half. They settled at 237 and one quarter. May futures were off a penny as well. 242 and a half the high, the low at 241. May's next year contract at 241 and a half for 2006. Off 1. May oats, 156 and a half the high, the low at $1.53 and a quarter, settled $1.54, down 2 3/4 in the July, down a penny and 3 quarters today, with a 153 settlement price, the high at $54 and 3 quarters, and the low at $1.51 and 1 half for the July oats. From the soy complex, nearby May contract, 621 and a half the high, the low at 613 and a half, settlement price at 616 and a quarter. They were down 3/4 of a cent today. July futures, 627 the high,
July, the low at 619.25. The settlement price is 622, down 1. And August futures, 625, the high, the low at 616.5, settled $6.20. They were down 1 cent for the day. September contract, 614, the high, low at 606.5, settled 608, down 3. In November futures, 608.5, the high, the low at 599.5. And a settlement price there at 603, they were down 3 cents. January futures, 608, the high, the low at 603, settled 604.5, down 2.5. A couple of other interesting things that we'll have during the closing market report this afternoon. Dave Dickey, your director of agricultural programming here in the newscast, will tell us about BT10 from Syngenta. It appears the Japanese corn market may be closing down because that particular event for BT corn hybrids has been showing up in U.S. feedstuff corn, and the Japanese are not very happy about it, and they may be closing the marketplace off. Now, bean meal futures for the day. Nearby May contract, 189.30 the high, the low at 186.20, settlement price at 187.40. They were down 90 for the day. And July bean meal, 187.70 off 140 with a high of 190 and a low at 186.50. And the May bean oil, 22.75, the high, the low at 22.43. Settlement price there, 22.64. They were up 22. July bean oil, 22.92, the high, the low at 22.60. Their settlement at $22.79, and they were up 19 cents for the day. Here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Looks like a mostly higher day today on the Merc. Lean hogs were higher today. May bellies higher. Feeder cattle were mostly lower, and live cattle, the contracts that we follow, they were lower as well. April feeder cattle, 109.70 the high, 109.30 the low, 109.70 the settlement, that up 40. May, 106.40 the high, 105.55 the low, 106.22.5 the settlement, that down 2.5. August, 107.67.5, the high, 106.90, the low, finishing at 107.57.5, down 20. April live cattle, 90.10, the high, 89.10, the low, the settlement, 89.45, that down 47.5. June, 85, even the high, 83.90, the low, 84.42.5, the settlement, that down 42.5. May lean hogs, 76, even the high, the low, 75.10, the settlement, 75.85, up 50. June, 78.22.5, the high, 77.15, the low, 77.90, the settlement, that up 65. July lean hogs, 78.35, the high, 77.45, the low, 78.10, the settlement, that up 52.5. August, 75.87.5, the high, the low, 75.22.5, finishing at 75.77.5, that up 55. May bellies, 87.30, the high, 85.87.5, the low price today for May bellies. And the contract finished today at 86.97.5, up $1.10. The Dow is currently off 130 points at 10,149. The NASDAQ off 27 at 1920. The S&P 500, 12 lower at 1150.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Dana Dykeman from Wapp Falls, New York writes, "Dear Dr. Science, why do all the worms crawl up and die after a rainstorm? Is the smell of the air after it rains caused by the odor of their decay?"
It is the death of all those worms that...